I was safe for the next 200 yards, but then I would have to decide. Getting across bandit country was a serious business. Selecting the right route was not a minor detail, but a matter of life and death. I knew they would be out there, watching, plotting, hunting me. I wondered what the captain would do. Always have a plan B. Better still, have a plan C too, he had said. Remember, no battle plan ever survives the first engagement. You must be flexible. He looked up from the maps laid out on the table in my quarters. The small space was lit only by torchlight, giving him a ghostly demeanour. I was almost at the jumping off point now. The mission was to reach the target, get back unseen. It would be very bold to take the main route. They would surely consider this a tactical error, but it would be an excellent double bluff, first-rate brinkmanship. I wondered how smart they really were. Never underestimate your enemy, the captain had drummed into me. Arrogance will always bite you on the arse. The alternative was the long way home, the concealed route. It would take me around the back of the buildings. There was plenty of cover, but crucially, my vision would be restricted. Once committed, I would easily be outmaneuvered, caught like a rat in a trap, and then driven into a waiting ambush. The captain had been adamant. You are to avoid contact where possible. We give diplomacy a chance first. There was snow on the ground. It was getting colder, and the winter light was beginning to fade. Good for stealth, I thought. But perhaps that's what they were thinking too. Time to choose. Time to move forward. He was waiting for me as I crossed our perimeter, standing steely-eyed at the door of the compound. How was the mission? He asked. Routine, Captain. I took the direct route. There was no contact. The opposition had their heads down. Maybe they have given up, I said. Ha! That'd be a first in military history, he grunted. They'll be back. They're building for something, a big push. And we'll have to be ready. Okay, get yourself a brew, debrief your quarters, 1600 hours. There was an early briefing the next morning and the captain spoke gravely. I see little chance of common sense prevailing. It now seems that we shall have to resort to force. If I were in command of their operation, I would organise a defensive line from which to launch an attack here. He used his swagger stick to point to the map, taped to the wall. It's perfect for them. They can bring their entire strength to bear, and difficult for a commander to resist. This is the option we shall plan for. We will engage them on their preferred ground and deal with them decisively. This is how we shall do it. I was at the start line, waiting for the off. I thought of the legions of men that had gone before me, set to, resolute on the threshold of battle. The silence was a mixed blessing. Calmly, I ran through the detail of the attack in my head. I wondered how it would go, how I would conduct myself. In my mind, I could see Harold Godwinson and his housecarls standing in their battle lines, their axes sharpened, ready to engage the conqueror, whose claim to the throne of England was given legitimacy by the papal banner cracking in the breeze. I saw Henry V rallying his archers and noblemen, his broad sword raised defiantly aloft against the assembled might of France on the field of Agincourt. The fighting spirit rose up to meet me like a gift from the mists of time. I was ready. The captain's plan was counterintuitive but brilliant. I was watching, waiting as the light faded. It was very, very cold, my breath, smoke. I moved off exactly 10 minutes later than normal. If the captain was right, the enemy would already be dug in and lying in ambush at the end of the long way home. I had no way of knowing if that was what they had done, but as I advanced, I saw their scout ahead of me. In the cold air, his rapid, excited breathing gave his position away. His job was to tell the others when he saw me enter the alley, which is exactly what I did. The battle lines had now been drawn. Speed was essential, Both flanks of the alley were made up of garden fences and garage doors. It was just wide enough for a car, curving gently southwards, taking me all the way to my house. I ran along it, quickly making fresh tracks in the snow, crouching, keeping my head down. I was to get most of the way along before going to ground. They would know soon enough when I'd set off. The plan was to wait, make them impatient. When the scout raised the alarm, they would become anxious too, feeling the cold for the first time in their apprehension. If they sent another scout, I would deal with him ruthlessly, an emphatic declaration of intent. If they come together, engage them with speed and aggression, and at any cost, the captain had ordered. From my prepared position, I could hear them. They were bickering like the rabble they were, needlessly giving their positions away. Superior strength had given them a false sense of confidence. They were killing time, complacent and poorly organized. Then suddenly, they fell silent. Fraser was sent first. How predictable, I thought. He came gingerly up the line, wide-eyed, like a timid, nocturnal intruder. His short trousers were a couple of turns too small for him, knees blue with cold, his outsized satchel an unhelpful burden. Fraser's father owned the local fish and chip shop, and his clothes reeked of cheap cooking oil. He was a hapless fool and too stupid to know he was being used by Fletcher. Their destinies alphabetically conjoined by way of the school register. Fletcher the bully, Napoleon with his fat, porcine features fixed in a perpetual sneer, the youngest in a succession of squabbling, delinquent brothers. When I moved on Fraser, I thought he would faint. His face, before I hit it with a compact left uppercut, had turned the colour of snow. The impact froze the scream on his lips, snapping his mouth shut with a sharp crack. Obligingly, his head had lolled to the side, sighting perfectly on my incoming right cross. The devastation of this blow, ground zero being the point of his chin, had the effect of cutting communications between his brain and legs. A crumpled heap on the ground, he began to sob bitterly, a burgeoning dark stain steaming at his groin, an acrid stench assaulting the clear evening air. I moved on. Fletcher, number 12 in the class ledger, but now standing at the rear, Gower, 13, and his cousin Crichton had lost their discipline. They'd been sucked into no man's land by their own curiosity, but were not advancing. They had no momentum, a fatal mistake on the field of battle. And I was sure the sight that greeted them sent the first icy chill of fear through their ranks. One quarter of their strength had been lost and humiliated in the first exchange. This was not what they had intended, and was far from the dominance they had become accustomed to. They'd been looking to trap and draw me into fight on my way home from school for weeks. They had made my life a misery, and they had loved it. Their obvious discomfort at my sudden advantage made me even angrier, and I marched forward, pressing home the attack towards the prize, Fletcher. When it was over, I stood amid the carnage of battle. The evening light was passing away amid the moans and sobs of the vanquished. Their blood stained the snow, an ephemeral testament to the deed done there that day. Soon it would pass into the mythology of my school, how a lone boy took on four bullies and dared to win. I imagined I was a Roman general at the head of an adoring army, counting the cost, savouring the moment. Crichton was clutching his ruined nose and weeping. He had incredibly gathered his stocky frame for the fight, but I was already upon him. He opened up with a left jab. This I parried with my right hand, set close to my face. Crucially, this got me close to him, and as he tried to cock a right hook, a poor choice, I set my feet and drove my right fist powerfully into his head. The resulting crimson explosion was spectacular. I felt his blood spatter my cheeks. And as the light of surprise in his eyes told me that this was going to be enough for him, I heard the captain speak. "Remember, a decisive action. There's no room for sentiment in war." And as Crichton's hands reached up to nurse the extensive damage inflicted upon him, I took a half step forward, dropped my shoulder whilst delivering an unopposed left hook through his right floating rib. He was trying to breathe through newly aligned nostrils, alarmed by a distinctive liquid rattling, which sounded uncannily like that of a pig with its snout in the trough. "Would you like me to straighten it for you?" I asked pleasantly. "My mother wants me to be a doctor. This could be the start of my new medical career." I could see in his eyes that he was horrified at the prospect, and he shook his head. I almost felt sorry for him. Gower had fought well. He was a skilled fighter, and I had felt his punches. The difference between us had been about passion. I was prepared to win at all costs. To die even, he was not. Now he was on his hands and knees, frantically searching the freezing snow for one of his front teeth. He clutched the other like a prize in his left fist. I'd removed them both with a sharp headbutt. He'd been saved from swallowing them by the brutality of the blow to his solar plexus, which had launched them into the evening. Such was the compression of his escaping breath. He was short-sighted and his bleeding face was so close to the ground, another absurd snuffling hog. I resisted the temptation to kick his raised backside. "Whistling may be a problem for a while," I said. I could taste blood in my mouth. I was elated, my senses bursting with vibrant and vital life. This was how victory felt, and I liked it. But there was sadness too. I remember the day my father's commanding officer came to visit my mother. I sat secretly on the stairs and listened. In my mind, I could see my dad. His battle dress was torn and bloodied, and he had a severe cut across his forehead. Beneath the turret seat, his driver's eyes stared lifelessly up at him. The tank was quickly filling with choking black smoke, and orange flames were sniping at his boots. His hands trembled slightly as he reached upwards to open the hatch. It seared the flesh of his fingers, but he kept trying. The blast had bent it out of shape and jammed it shut. Hanging back at the rear of the action, Fletcher had watched his loyal lieutenants crumble under the pressure and precision of the attack. Weeks of fear and anguish fueled my fury, and it had burned with the intensity of magnesium. They'd reaped the whirlwind, had been summarily punished. One last act of vengeance remained. I heard the captain quote Tacitus, "On the field of battle, it is a disgrace to the chief to be surpassed by his companions." "Fletcher," I yelled to him. But instead of joining battle, exchanging blows that would burst white needles of light behind my eyes, he faltered. His stature had diminished, his shoulders rounded, and dark shadows had appeared around shrunken, fearful eyes. He looked away from my steely gaze, then he turned and ran. I let him go, squealing like a terrified farm animal, lumbering off on fleshy legs from the colourful livery of the slaughterhouse van. It had been a highly successful action. The captain's plan had worked well, and together we had carried the day. I saw him for the last time, standing alone further down the alley. He nodded in silent approval. His battle dress was ragged and blackened. There was dried blood on his face. I picked up my school cap from the snow and placed it firmly on my head. I stood smartly to attention and saluted him. He raised the bandaged hand and with a broad smile returned the compliment. "Thanks."